The acclaimed author Pat Conroy endeared himself to many readers, perhaps Southerners most of all. His love for Charleston and the Lowcountry provided ongoing inspiration for his work. Shortly before he died last year, Pat Conroy wrote the foreword for The Cigar Factory, a novel of Charleston by Michelle Moore. In that introduction, Conroy wrote, "This is a large-hearted novel with a cast of characters wholly original in the vast, tempestuous literature of Charleston. Ultimately, it is the generous narrative of The Cigar Factory that makes this novel transcendent." We're joined now by the author, Michelle Moore. Welcome to City Lights.
Thank you, Lois. It's an honor to be here.
Well, that was no small praise from the likes of a literary great like Pat Conroy. And this is your debut novel.
Yes.
What made you decide to write it?
Well, I think I've heard that you have to have a question that you're trying to answer to get through the journey of writing a full novel. And one of the questions maybe has been about my father's accent, because he was from Charleston. And we grew up here in Atlanta. He moved to Atlanta after the war. And people would always say, you know, where's your father from? He's got such an unusual accent. And maybe trying to get to the roots of what that accent, where it comes from, ended up being a central part of the novel.
Well, in telling the stories, you present the lives of two families from the turn of the 20th century through the first half of this century, or through World War II. Who are those families?
The Malia Amy Ravenel is African-American. She's a devout Catholic. Her husband, Joe Ravenel, is a captain in the Mosquito Fleet, and they were a legendary group of African-American fishermen who rowed 5 miles out to sea beyond the jetties every day to fish and bring back fish to Charleston. They would feed up Charleston. So researching the Mosquito Fleet was, all the research was wonderful, and I enjoyed it very much. Hopefully that shows. Malia Amy works in the basement as a stemmer, processing and stemming the tobacco. Cassie McGonigal and her niece Bridget are Irish American. They work upstairs as cigar makers. They are also devout Catholics.
Yes, and they share some supernatural beliefs with
yes.
the Gullah. Indeed, both families are equally devout, although they attend different churches to begin with. Now, writing your first novel was ambitious enough, Michelle, but you took on the added challenge of writing in the Gullah Geechee dialect. Tell us about the background of that language and why you thought it essential to write in dialect.
Well, I resisted it as much as possible and was certainly warned by just about everybody not to do that. And I had, during the research, I recorded interviews with my family members, many in their 80s and 90s, and friends of the family, to help me with setting what they did for fun in the 20s and 30s in Charleston, what kinds of foods they ate, and so forth. And I would listen to the recordings over and over again, and it quickly became apparent to me that, you know, the way they spoke, it was inescapable. There was that accent again, and that there was something that needed to be preserved about that. People would warn me that the book would never get published if I wrote in dialect. And the language evolved quite a bit. So, and it's the way it is presented now is in snippets. I call it little channel markers along the Gullah Geechee Charleston English spectrum. So it's just in snippets or a phrase or a word, maybe a paragraph at most when a new character is introduced or when there's a really emotional outburst.
But you include a glossary.
Yes.
And I noticed that after a little while, I didn't need to refer back to the glossary, which was certainly attests to your mastery of the dialect.
It's a testament to revision. There was a lot of revisions, and always trying to get that balance just right, so not to tax the reader. I mean, I think you can't go into dialect without considering its history, which is that it's been used to show horrible condescension. A lot of harm, you know, has been done with the use of dialect, so I wanted to be respectful and, you know, to keep in mind that you can't fatigue your reader. So it is in snippets.
Well, some words are poetic. I loved day clean and sun lean. What do those words mean?
One of the features of Gullah and West African languages is often the use of a phrase to express a single idea. And those are some of the most beautiful and poetic discoveries that I found. So day clean would mean that the sun has risen and it has washed the night clean, you know, so it's day clean. What was the other one?
Sun lean
for doubt. So sun lean, kind of the position of the sun in the sky that it leans for down. Sun lean is when it's first starting to go into twilight, and then lean for down when it's almost set.
Oh,
and first dark would come after that.
Yeah, twilight, it's magnificent. Well, to anyone unaware of the speech patterns of Charleston English, it's striking to learn how much is shared between the blacks and whites. Now, with their capture and being thrown together in abominable conditions, together from different parts of Africa, it makes sense that the slaves had to develop one language so they could understand each other. But you bring out how much the Gullah Geechee influenced the white dialect. How did that occur?
Well, the population in Charleston was primarily people of African descent until the Great Migration in the 20s. Housing was never legal. It wasn't, you know, segregated housing was never the law in Charleston. So blacks and whites lived very much close together and in proximity. So there was that. And also, you know, European immigrants would have learned English than how it was spoken around them. And how it was spoken around them was primarily a population of people of African descent. Also, the well-to-do people are going to be raised by a da, which is a Gullah word for nursemaid or nanny. And I've heard many that when they arrived at their private schools, Portugal, Ashley Hall, they spoke such thick Gullah from having learned language from their da that they kind of struggled with standard English. And those stories haven't been told, and I'm honored, you know, to kind of, I hope, be the one to start putting this together in a way that's accessible and fun like a novel.
Oh, yeah. Well, would you read a portion? I was thinking a great example of how the Gullah Geechee imbues the white English is on page 251, and it's not the nicest character who's speaking here.
Okay, let's see. And we're, let's see.
Oh, I should cue you further.
I see one that says, go to,
no,
not there.
No, we're going to be radio friendly and right. Begin in the second paragraph with, let me introduce you to the women you're going to be working with.
Okay, let's see. Okay, let me, so that paragraph there.
Yes, all right. In your best Charlestonian.
All right. So this is Mr. Godfrey, I believe. And he says, don't worry, Miss Cassie, he said when she arrived to the fourth floor. So Cassie is, this is during the strike, and she is anti-union, doesn't want to participate. And she's been an examiner, which is a great job, but now she's been called because of the strike to go back up to the floor to make cigars. And it's been a long time since she's had to do that. So she's now up on the floor. They've called in women from payroll and accounting and so forth, and she's to be the one to show them what to do. So this is the foreman speaking. Don't worry, Miss Cassie, he said when she arrived to the fourth floor. We're going to slow it down till you get back in the swing of it. Let me introduce you to the women you're going to be working with. This here, Martha Sue, she normally works in clerical. And this here, Sally, she work in payroll. This gonna be temporary. More of our boys coming home every day. They gonna need jobs too. Our boys gonna come home and run these reds that's stirring up trouble with our darkies out of Charleston. You girls done the right thing, and the company appreciates your loyalty. Okay, let me show you how to work this here machine.
The absence of verbs?
Auxiliary verbs are often
amazing.
Absent.
It's amazing. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michelle Moore. She's talking about The Cigar Factory, her novel of Charleston. We'll be back after a short break on City Lights.
Support for WABE comes from The Fresh Market, celebrating 35 years of fresh foods with in-store samplings and events throughout the month of April. Details at thefreshmarket.com. And from the 81st Annual Atlanta Dogwood Festival, presented by PNC Bank. This springtime tradition brings fine art, music, the Mimosa 5K, and on-site tasting events to Piedmont Park, April 7th through 9th. More at dogwood.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, here with you and Michelle Moore, author of The Cigar Factory. The chapters alternate between the two family stories and the unifying experience is the women's employment at The Cigar Factory over the decades. Would you take us through their working conditions?
Cassie McGonigal and her niece Bridget work upstairs in the factory as cigar makers in the early 20th century. They wear a white uniform with a green work smock, and they roll cigars by hand. Early in the 20th century, when they were rolling cigars by hand, there were no machines, so it was quiet. And I would look at archival photos and kind of imagine, okay, you know, what would young women, hundreds of young women on this big floor, what are the sorts of things they would be talking about and bantering about? And, you know, you see them very close together. TB was an issue. Everybody's packed in there. We had many women in our family that worked at the cigar factory. One cousin spoke of how the windows were closed because, and I read this as well, they didn't want the breezes to dry out the tobacco, so the windows were kept closed. So the air was really, full of this ammonia, which is given off when processed tobacco leaves are torn. I've heard my father described it, I know you said it was radio friendly, as horse urine and kerosene, as a cross between horse urine and kerosene,
yeah,
the smell.
The stench permeates the working conditions and does not let up throughout the book.
Right. And down in the basement, Malia Amy and her friend Bina, they're processing and stemming the tobacco. So there's even more tobacco present. When the tobacco comes in from the field, it has excrement on
yes.
it, and and they have to treat it with insecticide and things that you'd never want to, you know, work with or think about inhaling either.
Oh.
So the conditions down there are even worse. And the African American women had to wear a blue uniform, which I'm sure was intentional on the part of the large tobacco companies because that was the dress of slavery time. And these were things I found in the Charleston newspaper from the 20s. They were very proud of the cigar factory. It became the largest one in the world. And they would have articles from time to time kind of describing the different workstations in the factory, which were great for me as when I was researching.
How long did your research take?
I would say about 10 months.
That's all?
Yeah, I was working pretty efficiently early on, maybe 10 months to a year. And the revision on the book itself, I spent a lot of time on the language revision. So.
My goodness. Well, it certainly seems exhaustive, and you must have been up all night reading like they were up all night working. Much of the action of the cigar factory involves the women's work at the factory, but you don't treat the men as secondary characters. Who are the male lead characters, and what is their work?
Well, let's see. I think, you know, growing up, I would hear the stories. My father would talk about fishing, and he was a man of the sea, and a lot of the men in the family went to sea. And I always enjoyed, you know, growing up in Atlanta, hearing sea stories and storms and what have you. So this, the novel was also my avenue to get to indulge that side and those stories. So the character of Manus O'Brien, who marries Brigid, he's a merchant seaman. And I guess my grandfather was a merchant seaman. And so looking at his passport, where Manus goes, Aruba, some of the ports of call that he makes are, I took those from my grandfather's passport just to imagine, you know, it is fiction, so I was having to imagine these places. A lot of tobacco came from Aruba and Cuba. The character Joe Ravenel, who's Malia Amy's husband, like I said, he's a captain in the Mosquito Fleet. So kind of doing the research on the Mosquito Fleet and being able to incorporate some of the experiences they have when they're offshore fishing, that it was a lot of fun. And hopefully it doesn't read like it was exhaustive.
No. I was just thinking about your afterword, you know, and all the volumes you've cited, which were so helpful in your research. And I figured this was about 3 years worth of reading on your part. The male characters are wonderful. Manus O'Brien, his relationship with Aunt Cassie is interesting. She calls him her Bolshevik, which is certainly not a compliment, but he loves literature, and he particularly relates to the Irish poetry of Yeats. And in the end, their relationship has become so tender, but it's expressed in their intrinsic ways. His with words of affection, and in her very cool, keep it at a distance way of expressing her correctness. It's just beautiful to watch that relationship involved. And the boys in each family are also memorable. Vincent de Paul, I always want to say Saint Vincent de Paul, but little Saint Vincent de Paul is Malia, Amy, and Joe's son. And he is so smart, and he turns out to be a very talented musician. I think one of the most moving portions of the book is when Malia Amy has to explain to him what her great-grandfather did, his role in helping to build the mansions, and telling him about slave rebellions. Dignity looms so large. Would you talk about that, how excruciating it was to tell her son that story?
Well, what I tried to imagine, you know, I thought, how would a parent, how would a mom, you know, explain this legacy of enslavement to her son when what she wants to, of course, impart to her son is how to stand tall, how to be a man, how to have pride in your family and where you've come from. And so I thought, well, I guess the way, you know, I would try and do that is to tell a story of the past that is not going to be what, you know, you're going to hear from the mainstream, but this is where you should take pride. Your people were skilled builders. They were not randomly stolen from Africa. They were selected because the West African countries were rice-growing areas in Africa, and it's a highly skilled, highly technical process of growing rice. So those people were stolen for their skills as rice planters. And similarly, the carpentry, you know, the amazingly talented carpenters, iron workers. And so I thought, well, that would be how the mom would do it. She would tell her son, no, you know, you come from highly skilled workers, highly skilled artists of workers, the iron works and so forth.
My husband and I were in Charleston about a year ago for a wedding, and we were taking a walking tour. And in a garden, a lovely garden, we were very moved by a sculpture that was a monument to the slaves who helped build the Unitarian congregation in Charleston. One doesn't see many of those acknowledgments, which I think is why it's all the more important that these stories be spread widely for everyone to learn. The Cigar Factory is as much a novel as it is a social history of Charleston. And we meet several historic characters in the novel. I especially love the description of Marian Anderson's recital, as well as the early jazz greats we encounter. Would you talk about the impact that hearing Marian Anderson had on Malia Amy?
Well, the history in Charleston for music is pretty incredible, just as all of it is. But the Avery Institute was one of the normal schools, so people from the north came to teach black children, you know, in a classical education. So at the Avery Institute, their music programs were very classically oriented, and so Malia Amy and Joe, their goal is to get Kofi, which is his basket name, his given name is Vincent DePaul, but his basket name, the name they give his soul, is Kofi. He was born on a Friday. So they get him into Avery, where he is studying the classical tradition. The other large music influence in Charleston was the Jenkins Orphanage, and many of the jazz greats came from Jenkins Orphanage and then moved to Harlem during the migration. So they would come back to Charleston to play, which the Riverside Beach, none of that was made up. Those were all genuine. And so Duke Ellington came, Louis Armstrong, you know, these jazz greats were coming back to play at Riverside Beach. And then over at Avery, their tradition being of the classical influence, Marian Anderson actually came to Charleston to perform. So for Malia Amy is, you know, there's kind of that, it's hard to leave your family of origin. And for them, for Vincent DePaul to be at the Avery, he's also among the Brown elite, which was people of the Brown elite, often slave owners would will freedom in their will to their illegitimate children. And so there was a large, large population in Charleston, freemen of color originally, and they became so successful, a huge middle class, upper middle class population, and they would send their children to the Avery Normal School. So for Malia Amy and Joe, when they attend this concert that Mary Anderson is singing, they don't feel at home here in this auditorium. You know, they realize this is not their peers. So there's a lot of kind of feeling out of place for them. But yet when Marian Anderson sings, and it's the Ave Maria, something she recognizes from her early education up to sixth grade with the nuns, you know, it's a unifying moment.
We're hearing from the author, Michelle Moore, about her novel, The Cigar Factory. We're going to hear just a little bit of what Malia Amy would have experienced listening to Marian Anderson. And Malia Amy, upon hearing that, forgot every ache in her weary body. Now, Cassie believes that a cigar is a work of art, a thing of beauty, which, of course, in her strict Irish Catholic mind means it has a link with the divine. How do they eventually come together? How do the families come together in the couple minutes we have left? If you could just talk about the strike and the impact it has.
Well, they're throughout the novel, which spans many decades. You know, Cassie's not going to, she's a stony, bitter, off-putting woman. I believe Pat Conroy described her the most off-putting woman you'll ever come to love. So, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. It's many years. They're kind of crossing paths throughout the course of the novel. In the end, something happens that that Cassie feels is unforgivable.
And she invokes St. Thomas Aquinas.
And Well, there's lots of quotes going on and invoking the saints, and so she then stumbles out and she's kind of almost faint from what's happened, and Malia Amy is there and happens to bring her a cup of water, the Mama Goli, which is a Mende word for an elderly white woman, and so Malia Amy has always referred to Cassie as the Mama Goli. Because she's the oldest one in the factory, and she's seen her all these years. So it's kind of, and that begins a very it's a brief yet historical moment. And I had to portray a moment and know that it was just a moment. And I wasn't certainly going to try and portray that things are fine in 1946. It's a moment.
But they sing together on the picket line, and it seemed like there were echoes of "We Shall Overcome" in that refrain. But that's not the song.
Well, it was the Charles Tenley version in 1900, which was a field song, a song of promise. It was called "I'll Overcome." It was a very more faith-based song, a song of promise. And that song is attributed to first being sung on the tobacco workers' strike in Charleston in 46. And it's considered that years later, the version Pete Seeger and Guy Carawan adapted as "We Shall Overcome."
Yes. Well, this has been such a privilege to talk with you. Pat Conroy ended his foreword with, "She has given birth to a literary vision of Charleston that's never seen the light of day so brightly before." Michelle Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michelle will speak about her book, The Cigar Factory, this Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m., at the Auburn Avenue Research Library. The event is free and the public is invited.